It's interesting. John Howard once said interest rates will always be lower under the under a Liberal government. It was never true. Of course, the Reserve Bank sets interest rates, not the Liberal Party. But the reason interest rates are so low at the moment is because the economy is doing so badly.
Mm.
So it's not really something to brag about that your party's really good at having low interest rates. These days, that's basically the same as saying we're really good at wrecking the economy.
One for mum. One for Dad, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Australia Institute. And today we're discussing what exactly is happening with the economy.
Huge, huge news out of Australia, cutting interest rates.
In 2013, average wages and salaries in Australia have increased at just 2% per year.
Australian households are now spending more than they are earning. Consumer spending.
That is the slowest rate of wage growth since the 1930s.
We believe Australia is on the verge of their first recession in 30 years. We're talking about a complete crash in stocks.
There are lots of scary headlines and even scarier statistics. Australia's economy grew by just 1.8% in the year to March, when it should be growing at around 3%. The Reserve Bank has dropped interest rates to record lows, and people are buying less, and wages aren't going up. So to unpack some of these numbers, I'm joined this episode by Chief Economist Richard Dennis and Senior Economist Matt Grudnoff.
Richard, how's the economy travelling?
Well, not as well as we were told it was going to, of course.
We just had an election about how great economic managers the government is, and they won again.
And no matter how we voted, no one told the economy.
That seems like an oversight.
So we got all these votes for a strong economy, and that darn economy just won't listen.
It all begins with keeping our economy strong. A stronger economy where people have the confidence to invest more, to employ more.
So pretty much since the election, we've had a run of bad economic news. We've got GDP, gross domestic product, the indicator of the size of the economy. It's growing slower than it has for a long time. We've got very low wages growth. And the Reserve Bank, the body that manages interest rates to keep the economy growing, it's so worried. It's now cut interest rates to the lowest level ever.
Yeah.
But apart from that,
everything's going swimmingly.
All good.
We haven't seen economic growth rates like this since the global financial crisis.
Oh, the good old days.
Yeah, the good old days.
That's comforting.
And it's not like everything's crashing. It's actually all just sliding down slowly. It's we're kind of just sliding into all these difficulties.
Well, I guess that's preferable to a crash, but it's still not great news, is it?
But at least greenhouse gas emissions are up.
That's true. They're rising.
Oh dear, stop it.
Gas exports are up.
Yeah.
We're going to get some more coal exports.
So, like, just for those of us who aren't economists, I know we all kind of have understood instinctively why this is bad, but why is sluggish economic growth bad? What's the problem with it?
Well, it depends, of course, what parts of the economy are growing, but we use big indicators like GDP to give us a sense of how all of it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And if the economy isn't growing at about 3%, then it's not usually creating enough jobs for to simply maintain the unemployment rate at its existing level. So in the short term, slow economic growth is terrible for people who are already unemployed. It's bad news for people who think their boss might be looking to get rid of them. And in the medium term, it's very bad for the government in terms of the amount of revenue it will collect. And of course, you know, depending on where you've got all your millions invested, Ebony, it's often bad for people that are invested in shares that are banking on economic growth.
But what's interesting at the moment...
That was interesting, Matt.
Yeah, it was. This slowing in economic growth is a very one-sided. Normally, it sort of affects everybody, but corporate profits are growing quite quickly and wages, real wages, are going backwards.
Mm.
So the impact of this slowing in economic growth is not what we usually see. It's very biased towards affecting workers, whereas businesses, for the moment at least, are still doing quite well.
But in the long run, ultimately the employees are their customers, and that's why the retail sector is getting a bit nervous.
Mm. Yeah, and what we've seen actually in the latest GDP figures is that retail spending is the thing that's falling back. And so, we would expect that businesses are going to feel the crunch very soon when basically their customers run out of money.
And again, retail spending is falling back. That's an indication that people are kind of like, oh, things don't sound good, shouldn't spend my money. Is that what's happening?
That's right. We're seeing consumers becoming cautious. So obviously people who've lost their jobs or fear they're going to lose their jobs are starting to save up for tough times ahead. But others just start to think, well, I might postpone buying a washing machine, I might postpone buying a fridge, I might not go on holidays now. We call that discretionary spending. And yeah, obviously that's softening quite significantly. And of course it was the retail sector that were desperate to get penalty rate cuts through. A lot of people, us included, said at the time, you realise you're cutting the incomes of your customers. Well, I think, unfortunately for us all, some of those chickens are coming home to roost.
Banks are back in the spotlight this evening after the Reserve Bank made the historic move of cutting interest rates to a new all-time low.
The interest rate cut was all but ensured by the RBA Governor, Philip Lowe, when he spoke at the Economic...
The first cut in official interest rates in almost 3 years, with the official cash rate cut by 25 basis points to a record low 1.25.
The Reserve Bank decision to cut interest rates pushed the rate to a record low of 1.25%. Historically, entire elections have been fought and won over how high interest rates are and who's best able to keep interest rates down. That is, in the best interests of mortgage holders.
This election, ladies and gentlemen, will be about trust. Who do you trust to keep interest rates low?
A moribund, inward-looking industrial graveyard. A low growth, high inflation, high interest rates, 22% interest rates at their peak.
But who else is affected by low interest rates?
For mortgage holders, obviously lower interest rates are a good thing. It means you pay less interest on what you've borrowed, which means you either pay down your principal faster and pay your loan off faster, or you have money for other things. But there is a group that actually is disadvantaged, people who have savings, in particular, say, retired people who tend to have larger pools of savings. If the interest rate goes down, then obviously they get less money to live on from their savings that they're holding in bank accounts. So lower interest rates is good for one group in the economy, but it's bad for another.
It's also hard on young people who are saving up for a mortgage because, well, when they come to taking the mortgage out, the low interest rates will be good for them. But in the process of saving, it's actually hard for them. It's interesting, John Howard once said interest rates will always be lower under a Liberal government. It was never true. Of course, the Reserve Bank sets interest rates, not the Liberal Party. But the reason interest rates are so low at the moment is because the economy is doing so badly. Mm. So it's not really something to brag about that your party's really good at having low interest rates. These days, that's basically the same as saying we're really good at wrecking the economy. So if you vote for us, we're going to have a very slow economic growth. We'll have high unemployment. But hey, at least mortgages will be cheap.
Australia is stronger, growth is higher, unemployment is lower, and the budget is stronger.
Despite global economic headwinds, Australia's economy is strong. Bill Shorten's Labor Party, that we always know, can't manage money.
It's easy to forget in the hubbub and aftermath of a federal election that the last federal budget was just mere months ago. At the time, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg painted a very rosy picture about the health of the economy, and the Liberal Party ran its election campaign on the back of this budget, arguing that they were better economic managers than the Labor Party. And they won. But the reality is that Australia's economic health is not as good as the Treasurer led us to believe. So how do you fix sluggish economic growth when the rosy economic forecasts in the budget don't match up to the reality of the economy today, just 2 months after the budget was delivered?
Well, it's important to remember that we've only just had the Commonwealth budget just before the election.
Mm.
In fact, you know, to some extent, we moved straight from the budget to the election, and the budget was full of rosy economic growth, wages were going to pick up, productivity was going to pick up. You know, we should be living in the land of milk and honey by now. But only 2 months have passed, and what we're seeing is the forecasts within the budget are way off. And unfortunately, that's not uncommon these days, but I think we're seeing really quite a significant deterioration since the budget, which really wasn't very long ago. So the forecasts were way out. The question now is, what can we do about it? The main tools available to the government are what's called monetary policy, interest rates, and we've outsourced that. The Reserve Bank independently sets interest rates. It's obviously worried. That's why it's cut interest rates recently. And then there's fiscal policy, government taxing and government spending policies. Now, the obvious thing to do at the moment is for the government to stimulate the economy using its tax and spending policies. In fact, the Reserve Bank has encouraged them to do so. The Reserve Bank said, don't leave it all up to us. But the federal government has promised to have a budget surplus. So the Reserve Bank saying, please spend some more money. Now would be a great time to spend some more money. And the government has effectively said before the election, we promise not to listen. We promise not to use fiscal policy to manage the economy. We're so good at managing the economy, we're promising we won't. We're just giving you a budget surplus based on optimistic growth forecasts. And now that the economy's not growing like that, they're in a political problem and we're in an economic one.
And we should probably explain exactly what a surplus is. A surplus is when the government taxes you more than it gives back to you in services. So when it's taking more in taxation than it's handing back in spending, that's when we have a surplus. Now, obviously, if you're taking money out of the private economy, you're effectively taxing them more than you're giving back, then that's what we call contractionary. That will slow the economy down. The reverse, a deficit, is when the government is spending more, giving more to the private sector than it's taking away in taxes, and that's what we call stimulus or expansionary.
Mr. Speaker, taxes will always be lower under the Coalition.
We're saying that when taxes rise too high, we say we've got to give the money back.
We think that Stage 3, at a cost of some $95 billion down the track, is really a triumph of hope over economic reality.
That election was a clear referendum between Scott Morrison's vision of lower taxes and the Labor Party's views for higher taxes.
What we know right now is that the economy needs stimulus.
Currently making news headlines is the government's income tax cut plan. The tax cut measures announced in this year's budget build on tax cuts announced in last year's budget and are delivered in three stages. Stage one is largely targeted at low and middle income earners, while stage three will benefit mostly high income earners. Labor has announced that it will oppose the third stage, which would lock in $95 billion worth of income tax cuts in about 5 years' time. It's been described as a fiscal time bomb for a future government. But the bigger question is, will the tax cuts actually stimulate economic growth?
Tax cuts definitely can stimulate economic growth, but it depends on who you're giving the tax cuts to. So if you hand out $100, it depends on who you give it to in the economy. It depends on how much bang for your buck, how much stimulus you get out of it. If you hand $100 to a very wealthy person, then they're going to save a big chunk of that. Because wealthy people save because they're getting more than they actually need as far as money goes.
So they don't have to spend
it. They don't have to spend
it. So chances are, or they're more likely to save at least a bit.
If you give $100 to a very poor person, then in order just to meet their basic needs, they're going to spend it all. Poor people spend all of their income and they don't save. So if you want to encourage more spending through a tax cut, then you're better off giving a tax cut to low-income people and not giving the tax cuts to high-income people.
And is that what the government's doing?
Well, the government has a three-stage tax cut, and the first stage does do that reasonably well. Through what's called the low and middle-income tax offset, it will hand out a lot of money to middle-income people. The problem is the tax cuts further down that don't start ultimately until 24, 25, not for another 5 years, they're going mostly to high-income people. And the other thing, too, is if you want to stimulate the economy, then baking in tax cuts way out in the future is not particularly effective because you don't know what the economy is going to look like 5-10 years from now. So you're better off, if you're doing it to try and stimulate the economy, you want to do it now, or you want to have control over when it comes in.
And it's worse than that because we don't have any idea what the economy is going to look like in 4 or 5 years' time. The government's just proved that it can't forecast what's going to happen in 2 months.
Yeah.
It's only 2 months since the budget and we're already way out. So the government's saying, oh, of course we can afford big tax cuts in 5 years' time. I've projected very strong economic growth between now and then. So why don't we just pass the tax cuts now? A far more responsible approach would be to say, there's no need to pass income tax cuts now that don't kick in for 4 or 5 years' time. Who knows what the economy will be doing in 4 or 5 years' time? But what we do know is the economy is slowing right now. What we do know is the Reserve Bank is saying, would you please do something on the spending side to kickstart the economy? If, and it's a big if, we were taking managing the economy seriously, the government would give up on long-run tax cuts, it would give up on short-term promises about surplus, and it would start doing what the Reserve Bank and most economists are saying they should do, which is stimulate the economy right now. But I suspect they're going to do the opposite.
Yeah, so you've said that economic growth's the worst it's been since the global financial crisis, which is not a cheery thought, even though it's happening slowly and not all at once. Going back to the global financial crisis, what are the lessons that economists can tell us from those types of shocks to the economy that we should be heeding right now?
Well, what's interesting, we call it the global financial crisis. The rest of the world calls it the Great Recession. And the reason we don't call it the Great Recession is because we didn't go into recession. We were one of the few countries in the world that didn't do that. So what we did quite successfully back in 2008 was we stimulated the economy. We stimulated it in lots of different ways. We gave out cash in the short run. $900 checks were posted out. We had building and construction in a longer term sense. There was a lot of different programs that Treasury rolled out that allowed money in the short term, in the medium term, and into the longer term. And it was also all stuff that could be withdrawn. So it wasn't permanent. It wasn't like they cut taxes or they introduced new spending programs that couldn't be withdrawn. So when they were building school halls, for example, that program finished when we didn't need stimulus anymore and it's gone away. When we posted out $900 checks, we weren't posting out $900 checks every year. They were just one at a particular point in time. And that's the best way of stimulating an economy.
For many primary school principals, the federal government's second economic stimulus package surely feels like manna from heaven. The package includes $12.4 billion over 3 years.
Ken Henry said at the time that the government needed to go early, go hard, go households. The recession that we had in 1991 was terribly managed, and Treasury, to their credit, looked at, after the fact, how they advised the government, and after the debacle of the 91 recession we had to have, Treasury concluded that when the economy starts to slow, you can't pretend it's not happening. You have to go early. You have to act on the early warning signs. You have to go hard. There's no point actually just dabbling. And go households. Treasury's view was, as Matt was saying before, when you put a lot of money into the pockets of particularly low-income people, they'll just go out and spend it straight away.
Mm.
And it can take years to get a big infrastructure project built. Giving money to high-income earners who already saved their money might not have much effect, but go early, go hard, go households was really about pumping money into the economy when it was needed. Now, it's not obvious that we're at exactly the same point that we were in the GFC, but the government needs to be saving up its fiscal firepower to use in that way if the time comes along. But instead, it's promising surpluses in the short term that we probably don't need and tax cuts in the long run that we probably can't afford.
So is there anything else that we should know about what the government can do on the fiscal side of things?
Well, there's so many things they can do and some they'll try. They have incentives to get small businesses to invest. They'll offer incentives to some employers to retain or even employ new staff. There's interesting things the tax office did during the GFC, which made it easy for small businesses to delay paying some of their tax bills so that their cash flow didn't dry up because it was very hard to borrow during the GFC. So there's lots of small things that governments can do, but at a big picture level, we've got a nearly $2 trillion economy. $2,000 billion a year is Australia's total income. So when you hear people talking about spending a billion here or a billion there, it's literally rounding error. Mm. So if we do need to stimulate the economy through fiscal policy, we are not talking about small numbers. And again, because of the politics of this, we've got a coalition promising to have budget surpluses, even though the economy might need significant deficits.
The biggest problem we have is that what Costello convinced the public was is that to be a good treasurer, to manage the economy well, all you need to do was run a budget surplus. So run a budget surplus, tick, you're a good economic manager. But as any economist will tell you, that's just nonsense. Like, a budget surplus is good when the economy is booming. It's bad when the economy is tanking. And the problem I think that the coalition is going to have is that they're still tied up in that idea that run a budget surplus means you're a good economic manager. But if you try and run a budget surplus when the economy is going into recession, during a recession, your taxation dries up. So effectively, people are earning less, so you get less income tax. People are spending less, so you have less GST. Companies are making smaller profits, so you get less company tax. So if you then see your revenue stream dry up and then you try and cut spending further, all you're going to do is make the recession worse. In 2016, when then Treasurer Scott Morrison was asked whether stimulus was a good idea, he refused to say that stimulus was a good idea at any time.
Isn't it a problem that because you've made stimulus such a dirty political word, you've boxed yourself into a corner when it comes to your policy options?
No, I disagree with that, because the sort of stimulus that I won't engage in is handing out cheques to 16,000 deceased people, setting fire to people's roofs and overpriced school halls. That stimulus, I think, has been discredited, and rightly so.
Stimulus is overpriced, okay, though, as a principle.
It was overinflated, and it didn't get the job done.
Do you accept that
what
stimulus
we are focused
okay
on, Lee, is in focusing on investments in infrastructure. Structure that boosts
That's
what we
stimulus.
Can produce. Lee, look, you use the words you want to use. I'll use the words I want to use.
He was asked five times by Lee Sale on 7:30, and he refused to say that in principle stimulus was a good idea. Not that stimulus was good right now, but that at any time stimulus was a good idea. And that should be quite scary to everybody. It would be absolutely economically reckless to try and run a surplus if the economy turned down.
It might even be more economy wrecking than tackling climate change.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, we're stuck with a rhetoric about economic management that's out of kilter with the reality of economic management. The word surplus sounds like a good word. It's a nice word. And the word deficit is a bad word. It sounds like a bad word. But it's just a word. And as Matt said, a surplus means the government is taxing you more than it's giving back on services. I don't want that. Why would anyone want to live in a society where the government... Why do right-wingers who hate big government, why do they love the idea that the government taxes us more than it gives back in services? And they don't. They just like the word.
Yeah.
And similarly, a deficit simply means that in a particular 12-month period, you've spent more than you earned. Well, anyone that's ever bought a car has probably spent more than they earned that year. They probably borrowed to finance it. They ran a deficit. Anyone that's ever bought a house has spent more than they earned that year. But we don't tell people that bought a house they're recklessly racking up debts and deficits. We say, oh, that's probably a good idea in the long run. So the idea that a deficit is bad and a surplus is good, it's powerful storytelling, they're nice words, but when it comes to actually reducing unemployment, creating jobs and tackling social problems, these words are now getting in the way of a meaningful conversation about the economy.
I want to turn quickly just back to monetary policy. That's the RBA effectively setting interest rates. What role does that play in tackling a sluggish economy?
Well, what's interesting is fiscal policy and monetary policy are the two tools. Monetary policy tends to work best as a preventative. It's a bit like, making sure that you're fit and healthy to stave off, illness. But when a crisis occurs, people panic and people, as we've said earlier, people stop spending, they start saving. So if you try and reduce interest rates, all that people do is they try to pay down their debt faster. They don't necessarily spend it. And so what we've found in the past is that during a crisis, monetary policy is far less effective. Fiscal policy, on the other hand, can be very effective during a crisis. Why? Because the government can spend directly. The government can go out there and buy stuff directly. It doesn't have to go through worried households. It can also direct which households get that stimulus. So if it gives it to particularly low-income households, they don't have a capacity to save. They will just go out and spend it. And so if we go into recession, fiscal policy is a far more effective tool than monetary policy.
And so effectively what you're saying too is it's more of a blunt instrument.
Monetary policy is a very blunt instrument. As Matt said, it's very hard to aim it at people, but even just across the country, what's happening in the West Australian economy and what's happening in the Tasmanian economy might have almost nothing in common, but we've got the one currency and we set interest rates across the country. So monetary policy is a very blunt instrument. We can't aim it at demographic groups. We can't aim it at geographic groups. And it's often has what economists call a long lag. It's a long time before dropping interest rates leads to the kind of changes that that we need.
And so the RBA's just dropped interest rates. How many more times can it do that if it needs to?
Well, economists get a bit excited about how low can interest rates go and
can, how low can you go?
And can you have a negative interest rate? And but look, the answer is it can't go much lower. The RBA usually changes interest rates by 0.25% at a time. It can change them by as much or as little as it wants. But it doesn't have many more 0.25% reductions up its sleeve before we start heading to negative interest rates. Now, get excited about that. Negative interest rate means if you borrow money, someone will pay you for it. And it happened. It happened during the GFC.
Really?
Yeah.
The most recent data, including the GDP and labour market data, do not suggest we are making any inroads into the economy's spare capacity. Given this, the possibility of lower interest rates remains on the table.
My other question now is, how did we get here? What's gone wrong?
Well, Labor.
Absolutely.
I mean, who else? I mean, the coalition's only been in for 6 years, so
clearly it's Labor's fault.
I think it's Labor's fault. I go back to Hawke and Keating. There's an accumulation of economic mistakes. We talk about low wage growth as if it kind of happened like bad weather. But we have low wages growth because we pushed wages down. We changed the laws. We got rid of penalty rates. We made it harder for people to join unions. We made it harder for unions to push for higher wages.
And lo and behold, we've got low wage growth.
Which, of course, was the goal of policy for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's like the dog that finally caught the car. Like, we've spent my whole adult life, you know, hearing business groups talk about how to constrain wages growth, and we've done it. Yeah. And it's
Congrats.
A disaster. And, you know, it's slowing down the whole economy.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of people standing around pointing, saying, oh, I think she did it. No, I think it was him. Well, we've tried for 20 years to do it, and it's mission accomplished. It was just a dumb mission. And then there's fiscal policy. We've been running restrictive fiscal policy, contractionary fiscal policy, probably for too long. But also we've been investing poorly in skills, poorly in training, poorly in research and development, and we now have some of the lowest productivity growth we've got on record as well. Presumably Labor's fault from something they did back in 1995, But big picture, pinko lefty groups like the IMF and World Bank now say quite clearly inequality is bad for economic growth.
Yeah.
Well, we've caused a lot of inequality in Australia in the last couple of decades, and guess what? Now we've got very sluggish economic growth. It's not the only cause of it, but it's a big cause.
Mm.
The fact is the economy's struggling. We have very low growth. We have wages that are not keeping up with the cost of living.
The economy is slowing under them, that the Reserve Bank is taking emergency measures, living standards are going backwards, that underemployment is higher than it should be, that the debt has doubled. We have to hold the government to account for its failings and make sure that we have an alternative offering that shows that we are focused on a strong economy with successful businesses generating good jobs and services and safety nets that people rely on.
Both parties have presided in government over a long period of time, and we've sort of just been building up these problems where We're moving away from trying to use economic tools in order to manage the economy, and we're turning those tools into targets. So the target is to run a budget surplus. The target is to have low interest rates. No, both of those things are tools that you manage the economy with. It's a bit like a shovel, right? A shovel is for digging dirt. You don't put the shovel on the mantelpiece and admire it. Some people might.
You want to come round on the weekend?
Yeah, you know, come and have a look at my shovel. Right? You usually get a shovel because you want to move dirt. Well, you know, surplus deficit is the shovel. Sometimes we should have a deficit and sometimes we should have a surplus. Interest rates are the shovel. Sometimes we should have low interest rates, sometimes we should have high interest rates. And we need to get away from this fantasizing about the tools and making them the objective and loving them, and just understand that they're there to help us manage the economy to make things better for all of us.
But my shovel's so bright and shiny and clean.
I'll do a subscription to Shoveler's Fancy magazine.
So if this is what's happening in Australia, what's happening overseas?
Look, we live in interesting times. We've got America and China starting a trade war, literally.
And if you'd said that 5 years ago, we would have laughed at you. You know, that we would have had a trade war with increasing tariffs on both China and the US.
So that's literally affecting trade flows between the two biggest economies in the world, but it's also making a whole bunch of people who would usually be investing in what they expected to be world growth, thinking, yeah, gee, I'm not quite sure now's the right time to do that. So there's no doubt international events are causing some of these problems, as, of course, international events caused the global financial crisis. But, of course, the coalition blamed the global financial crisis on Labor, certainly the deficits they ran to minimise its economic harm. And presumably they'll try and say, look, the dog ate my homework, don't blame us. I'm just running the economy, but you can't expect me to cope with changing world events. I didn't put a trade war in my forecasts, so therefore it's unfair if there is one. But the reality is, of course, we live in a messy world, and yeah, that's why you've got to keep your instruments available.
The world's a big place, and there's always some kind of crisis happening somewhere in the world, and there's always economic headwinds somewhere in the world. Certainly there are problems at the moment, but there's been plenty of problems in the past. And so I don't think it's an out for government. If they want to be good economic managers, they should be able to manage in the good times and the bad times.
That's been episode 36 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. It was recorded on the 9th of June 2019 in Canberra with Richard Dennis and Matt Grudnoff, and some things may have changed since this conversation was recorded. The Australia Institute has done a lot of research on the state of the economy and the income tax cuts package, and you can find all of that on our website at tai.org.au. We're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T. Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. And Matt Grudnoff is at Matt Grudnoff with a double F. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy and Lizzie Jack. Our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. You can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thanks for listening.